Eye has not seen, nor has ear heard, neither has there entered into the minds of men the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. For He who spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how shall He not with Him freely give us all things? He has done exceedingly abundantly beyond all we could ever ask or think, for we have the mind of Christ. And you may open the mind of Christ this morning to 1 John 1, verse 8. 1 John 1, 8, as far as we've gone, we're into the process, and it reads, if we assert that we do not have an old sin nature. As we were closing out our study on Thursday evening, we noted some conclusions about such a person's attitude, and we drew these simply from this short process. First of all, a person who asserts that he has no sinful nature also contends he does not sin. Now, it's possible to sin without a sin nature. Adam showed that. It's all volitional. So you can decide to break the status quo of perfection by entering into an original sin. And that's what Adam did. But these individuals seem to think that since they don't have a sinful nature, they don't sin, aren't sinning, and therefore are perfect, I assume. Secondly, the opinion that he has no sin leads to the opinion that he is righteous before God. Now, how this occurs comes up thirdly. This means that he considers his standards of behavior to be righteous. This is the holier-than-thou crowd. They establish within their own souls a set of standards that they believe reflect perfection. They abide by them, and therefore they are good with God. So by complying with these self-established standards, he reinforces his view of personal righteousness. Five. This attitude is indicative of self-righteous arrogance, which is gate four of the arrogance complex. Six, belief that one's standards are righteous and therefore superior motivates him to try and impose them on others. And seven, often at this point, the arrogance of self-righteousness interlocks with authority arrogance and power lust, as he seeks to impose his standards by force on others. Eight, those who disagree are considered benighted and become objects of ridicule, character assassination, and dictatorial control by the self-appointed anointed. This is a dangerous disposition that creates extreme asceticism in the church and tyrants outside it. In the church, such people head up clipboard committees, while in the political world, he can become a Robespierre and preside over a reign of terror. Now, I want to give you two excerpts from some writings as we move into our study today. Tyranny can take on many forms. It can be a husband over a wife. Why, heck, it can be a wife over a husband. It can be parents over children. It can be someone in a local community that runs roughshod over the people. I think of Henry Potter in It's a Wonderful Life. There can be those involved in politics who gain power, and they therefore are able to manipulate certain individuals and therefore gain power over the area of influence they have. The worst of all are those who gain such great power while believing that their ideas are right, that this self-imposed righteousness gives them justification to eliminate by force those who disagree. Now, this leads to great difficulties on every level I've mentioned. In a household, a husband believes he's right. The wife may or may not be correct, but she may disagree or not kowtow, and physical abuse occurs. It can even lead to murder. You can have child abuse to the point that a child dies because of the dictatorial, tyrannical control of the parent. You see retribution on occasion where a woman will murder her husband. She had rather be in jail than live with him. You see children retaliate against dictatorial, tyrannical parents. They had rather eliminate them and take the consequences than to continue and exist in that environment. You see revolutions and seditions occur in certain political arenas from time to time because the people are completely fed up with the totalitarian nature of their leadership. These things occur in the ebb and flow of history. And if you are observant of the historical trends in any given period or zeitgeist, you can almost become a prophet by looking into the not too far distant future and seeing how if things continue to go at their current pace, there's going to be blood in the streets. So I think that whatever level you want to examine this problem, the idea that we assert we have no old sin nature and therefore we do not sin, this is the kind of mental attitude that leads to overwhelming arrogance linked with power lust to impose wills on other people. Now you can go to what I think is one of the low points in all of human history, and not amazingly it occurred in France, and it is called the Reign of Terror. Now we won't go into a detailed study of this, but only to define terms which will bring to light some of the things we're noting. Now pull this simply from Merriam-Webster's Dictionary of Illusions. There are three entries that we're going to note. The first is the Reign of Terror. Here's the definition of this term. It is a time when a society, an institution, or community lives in fear of extreme violence by those in control. The phrase comes from the French Revolution, and when it's capitalized, specifically refers to the period in 1793 to 94, when France was ruled by the dictatorship of the Committee of Public Safety. This will become an oxymoron in a moment. On July 27, 1793, Maximilien François Marie Isidore de Robespierre joined the committee and immediately dominated it. How can a man like that, with a name like that, get the kind of power he got? What was it like on a playground for him at age 7? By the way, the pronunciation of his name depends on how you want to go with it. The anglicized pronunciation is Robespierre. The French pronunciation is Robespierre. Take your pick. I like the shorter version. In September, the convention adopted a resolution from the Jacobin Club proposing that, quote, terror be the order of the day. And the tempo of executions increased, led by Marie Antoinette on October 6th. Definitions of guilt were expanded and trials became utterly arbitrary. The terror was used to eliminate fellow revolutionaries in rival factions. But prominent political figures consisted only a small percentage of the casualties. A person could be seized, tried, and executed for a casual remark or even for weeping at the execution of a relative. About 3,000 people were executed in Paris, many more thousands in the provinces, especially where resistance movements were suppressed. Now, we used the term a moment ago of Jacobin. This needs to be defined. It was an extremist or radical political group. Listen to the definition of this crowd. Originally a member of a group advocating egalitarian democracy. Everybody is equal, and they will be equal as soon as we eliminate the opposition. They engaged in terrorist activities during the French Revolution. The Jacobins started out in 1789 as relatively moderate Democrats, but soon became the radical leadership of the French Revolution and ushered in the Reign of Terror. The club's members included some of the most influential leaders of the National Assembly: Count Mirabeau, Jacques Danton, Jean-Paul Marat, and Robespierre among them. Now, a little bit on Robespierre. a zealous leader of the French Revolution whose name is synonymous with ruthlessness and extremism. Now listen to the dossier on this fellow. Robespierre is one of the most radical of the radical Jacobins and virtual dictator of France during the Reign of Terror. An icy, priggish intellectual. Icy meaning cold-blooded. Priggish meaning holier than thou. Intellectual meaning that he was in intellectual arrogance. I'm smarter than you are, so therefore, if you are among the benighted, you're convicted. An icy, priggish intellectual with considerable powers for oratory. If you can communicate your idea in a way that people might buy it, or be fearful of your power so that they will comply and kowtow. That's oratory. Considerable powers of oratory and a reputation for incorruptibility. See, he had painted himself as a very righteous person. Robespierre was fanatically dedicated to the revolution. He instigated the executions of fellow revolutionaries, most notably Danton, who predicted on the way to the guillotine that Robespierre would soon follow. Danton was right. The terror ultimately consumed itself. Robespierre was overthrown on July 27, 1794 by deputies who disagreed with his policies and who feared they might be next to be shaved by the national razor, the guillotine. Robespierre was guillotined the next day with several associates. Now, in this dictionary, it gives how Robespierre can be used as an allusion. Here's an example from an article by Nat Hentoff in the Washington Post, an article in September of 1997, and he writes, some years ago, as the Robespierre-like political correctness movement was taking root in the colleges across the country, my son Tom was the editor of the student newspaper at Wesleyan. He was being pressured by his staff to mandate that the term fresh person be used henceforth to identify all incoming students. That's how Robespierre-like political correctness can emerge, and we've seen that in spades in our society since 1997, a decade ago. Now, I want to, at this time, bring something else to your attention. I thought that that was a good example of how someone who believes they're right can rise to a level of power, and with that belief functional, with power, with arrogance, and with wherewithal, can wreak absolute havoc upon a population. And we didn't even enter into the night of the long knives in describing the Reign of Terror. This next thing I want to read to you was written during the war between the states. It is an excerpt from a book by Thomas Fuller. Thomas Fuller was a pastor during that time, and he wrote several. These are not sermons, I don't believe. They do not appear in my mind to be sermons, but simply his writings on several subjects. Therefore, they were compiled in a book that was published in 1864 by Boston's Little, Brown and Company. The collection is called The Holy and Profane States. And the one that I want to present to you today is the one entitled The Tyrant. And I will only give you excerpts. Also, be aware that the vocabulary of the people who wrote a century and a quarter ago was quite advanced beyond ours. He writes that a tyrant is one whose list is his law. In other words, he makes up the law, his list rules. A tyrant is one whose list is his law, making his subjects his slaves. Yet that is but a tottering kingdom which is founded on trembling people, which fear and hate as their sovereign. He gets all places of advantage into his own hands. He would disarm his subjects of all scythes and pruning hooks, but for fear of a general rebellion of weeds and thistles in the land. He takes the laws at the first, rather, by undermining, then assault, and therefore to do unjustly with the more justice. He counterfeits a legality in all his proceedings and will not butcher a man without a statute for it. In other words, if you want to eliminate someone, you invent a law and then decree that this fellow has broken that law and butcher him for it. Afterward, he rages freely in innocent blood. Is any man virtuous? Then he is a traitor, and let him die. For it, let him die for it, who does presume to be good when his prince is bad. When you are a tyrant, you're looking for people who might seek to overthrow your power. Those who appear to be virtuous, therefore, are asserting that they are more righteous than you are. Therefore, they may draw the attention of the masses and must be eliminated. Is he beloved? He is a rebel, has proclaimed himself king, and reigns already in the people's affections. These are people who simply are liked broadly. They have a good reputation in the community and otherwise. And therefore, they are threats to power, and they have to be eliminated, and it must cost him his life. Is he of kin to the crown? Oh my. Is he of kin to the crown? Though so far off that his alliance is scarce to be derived, all the veins of his body must be drained and emptied to find there and fetch that dangerous drop of royal blood. You have a lot of that in Shakespeare. You eliminate all the competition within the bloodline. And thus, having taken the prime men away, the rest are easily subdued. And all these particulars, Machiavelli is his only counselor, who in his prince seems to him to resolve all these cases of conscience to be very lawful. Worst men are his greatest favorites. He keeps a constant kennel of bloodhounds to accuse whom he pleases. The less credit they have, the more they are believed, and their very accusation is held proof. The lowest of the society make up stories of character assassination, and they're used at proof as proof in whatever court there might be in this type of government. He seeks to suppress all memorials and writings of his actions. In other words, he wants to control history, the reporting of his history of his administration. For example, when tyrants have wronged and abused the times they live in, they endeavor to make them speechless, to tell no tales to posterity. So those who would write it and tell it to the next generation are suppressed or eliminated. And though it may be dammed up for one age, yet it will break over, and historians' pens will afterward feed more greedily on the memories of tyrants and describe them to their full. At last he is haunted with the terrors of his own conscience. If any two do but whisper together, whatsoever the propositions be, he conceives their discourse concludes against him. See, there are certain places where totalitarians rule that so many people can gather together in one spot because they assume that you're plotting something against the establishment. Company and solitariness are equally dreadful unto him, being never safe, and he wants a guard to guard him from his guard, and so proceeds infinitum. The scouts of Charles, Duke of Burgundy, brought him news that the French army was hard by, being nothing else but a field full of high thistles whose tops they mistook for so many spears. On lesser ground, this tyrant conceives greater fears. Thus in vain does he seek to fence himself from without, whose foe is really within him. He is glad to patch up a bad night's sleep out of pieces of slumber. In other words, he tosses and turns out of fear during the night times. They seldom sleep soundly who have blood for their bolster. His fancy presents him with strange masks, wherein only fiends and furies are actors. The fright awakes him, and he is no longer glad that it was a dream, but fears it is prophetical. In vain he courts the friendship of foreign princes, and they defy his attempts at friendship and will not join their clean hands with his bloody ones. Sometimes, to ingratiate himself, he does some good acts, but virtue becomes him worse than vice, for all know he counterfeits it for his own ends. Having lived in other men's blood, he dies commonly in his own. He had his will all his life, but seldom makes his testament at his death, being suddenly taken away, either by private hand or public insurrection. Well, there's a little taste of tyranny. The kind of tyranny that emerges from self-righteous arrogance. People believe they are right beyond question. They gain power. They have authority arrogance. They have power lust. And given the opportunity, they will seek to impose their views on others. And when this occurs, it can occur in a household all the way up to a national entity. You're aware of these things because you have the doctrine to observe and to analyze. But what we're seeing in this verse, what John presents to us, is a disposition of mind that enables a person to believe they are faultless, they are right, they are pure, and when a person believes that long enough, they will eventually, because a person of that disposition must function in the cosmic systems, where all of these gates eventually interlock one at a time. Authority arrogance, psychopathic arrogance, power lust, these things come together to lead a person to a level of authority and power, influence. Robespierre was a great orator, and he originally was thought to be incorruptible. And he murdered willy-nilly thousands of people over a period of a very short year or so in the latter part of the 18th century. When a person claims to have no sin, he must mean one of two things. First of all, that he has no sin nature and therefore has never committed a volitional sin in his life. A volitional sin includes thought, speech, or action. Never committed any of those. Or, secondly, he asserts that he used to sin back in the days of yore, but he has become so sanctified that he doesn't sin anymore. Ever. I'm done with that. Such ideas are implied in the protasis of verse 8, but John shoots them down in the apotasis. And here we can insert the inferential transitional conjunction that introduces the result of having a viewpoint, and that is the word un translated then. That introduces the apotasis. And the apotasis begins with the verb planao. P-L-A-N-A-O, planao. And planao means literally to go astray, to wander from the right way, and figuratively to mislead or to deceive. Now, it is accompanied with the direct object heautu, and together they mean we deceive ourselves. You get too cocky and you start believing too much in yourself, then what you have done is gone into self-deception. It is extremely dangerous to take the malleable souls of young children and convince them that they are enough. They're good enough, they're smart enough, they're better, they're blah, blah, blah. And the whole idea is to build self-esteem. There's nothing wrong with having self-esteem, but when it's taught in such a way that whatever the child believes is right is okay for him, then you're setting up young tyrants. They will demand things of others. They will assume that they're right. They are ripe for rebellion in the household, in the school, in the streets of society. We have too many young people who really are removed from reality because of psychopathic arrogance, bred into their souls by the idea that they are their own governors without any need for any exterior instruction or guidance. And when that attitude infuses into the minds of young people, they become uncontrollable and they become card-carrying terrorists at age 13 or about. They're not enough. They don't have the intelligence to be enough. I'm 66 next month. I'm as dumb as a post. I have been around, I have seen things, I've experienced a lot. And the more you know, the more you find out you don't know. So people who are teenagers haven't been alive long enough to know much, although they may be making excellent grades. But it is academic understanding. And academic understanding is good when you're taking tests, but it doesn't do much out on the street. Heautu plenao. We deceive ourselves. The verb plenao is a progressive present. It signifies action in progress or in a state of persistence. In the indicative mood, it is related to present times, so this person is in status quo self-deception. Status quo self-deception. Now, you got a problem here. If you know a person, and I'm not suggesting that you do, but should you run across a person who is in status quo self-deception, that person's thought processes are flawed by that disposition. They are operating from the concept that what they think, what they do, what they say is absolutely correct and righteous. And therefore, what other people do, what other people say, whatever their ideas are, they may be put down in a very gentle way by saying, you just don't understand. If you only understood as I understand, then you would see the error of your way. Active voice, believers who reside in the cosmic systems of arrogance and hatred produce the action of the verb. So a person with that disposition is not in the clear light of day of status quo spirituality. They are operating under deception, under delusions. And remember, Robespierre was very self-righteous and interpreted his own hatred and righteous indignation toward others who would not comply with his standards as noble civic duty. When you have someone who will invent laws, we saw it in Fuller's writing, we saw it in the playing out of the Reign of Terror under Robespierre. He thought, because he was so smart and righteous, that those who disagreed with him should be removed from society, and the guillotine ran red with blood in the Palace de Revolution. So he put them to the blade. Indicative mood to clarity for the reality of believer delusion. 1 John 1, 8. The Protestants, if we assert that we do not have an old sin nature, then, and this introduces the apodosis, the main clause which expresses the conclusion or the result of this conditional sentence, then we deceive ourselves. 15. If self-delusion is perpetuated over an extended period, then the believer enters into psychopathic arrogance, gate 7 of cosmic 1, and also blackout of the soul, stage 6 of reversionism. Now, your memory center may not flash back clearly to these, so let's define them. Repeating 15. If self-delusion is perpetuated over an extended period, you can be deluded and deceived on occasion, but if your doctrine's flowing with a great deal of fluidity, you're clear on rebound, you're concentrating on the doctrine, you know, you can slap your forehead and say, uh-oh, somebody's trying to pull a wool over my eyes. You can clear the decks and start over. But if you stay in the cosmic systems too long, an extended period, then such a believer enters into psychopathic arrogance, gate 7 of cosmic 1, and also blackout of the soul, stage 6 of reversionism. Now 16. Psychopathic arrogance is a mental condition brought on by a long series of bad decisions caused by self-deception and results in total divorcement from reality. This is a mental problem. 17. Blackout of the soul is a spiritual condition that results from prolonged failure to grow in grace. And this allows human good and evil concepts to directly attack the noose of the soul, since the human spirit's filtering process is shut down by unconfessed sin. Don't turn the page. You didn't understand that yet. Blackout of the soul is a spiritual condition. Psychopathic arrogance is a mental condition. When you are deluded, as a thought process involved, you're in the cosmic system and you're making decisions based on unreality. Now, when you move down to the blackout of the soul, that's reversionism, and that's when you've been out of fellowship so long, you're in a downward trend with regard to all aspects of your spiritual life. It results from prolonged failure to grow in grace. You grow in grace to a certain point, and then if you remove yourself from Bible study, like the second session crowd, if you remove yourself from Bible study, then there is a slow retrogression. And the slow retrogression gains momentum the longer you stay away from the Word. The longer you stay away, then the more control the old sin nature will gradually acquire over your thought processes. And when this occurs, there's an erosion of doctrinal thought and an infusion of human good, evil, and what have you. Therefore, the old sin nature is agent provocateur. They invade, they gain control of the command post of the soul, and you're back to thinking those things you were thinking before salvation, or, as the case might be, before you had any spiritual growth. And therefore, this allows human good and evil concepts to directly attack the noose of the soul. That's academic understanding. Data comes in. Academic understanding, you've got demon influence right there, concepts based on your self-deception and psychopathic arrogance, as well as delusions of various descriptions, and you believe it, and therefore you transfer it to long-term memory. You are replacing doctrine with human good and evil. You're replacing doctrine with the delusions of cosmos diabolicus. Now, how is that possible? It is possible since the human spirit's filtering process is shut down by unconfessed sin. If you are out of fellowship, your human spirit is shut down with regard to processing incoming data. And therefore, the grace apparatus for perception is no longer functional. You have removed yourself from Bible study. You have stayed away so long, there's erosion of doctrinal thought. There's an infusion into the mata otes vacuum of doctrines of demons, to summarize it briefly. And therefore, incoming data can come from many different places. You can sit in a Bible class with a pastor preaching, and you will interpret the things he says to coincide with your new frame of reference. Because nothing goes through the human spirit. The Holy Spirit's not functional. Old sin nature has gained control of the command post of your soul. The Holy Spirit has exited the soul back to the body. You are not in status quo spirituality, you're in status quo carnality. Incoming data, therefore, is misunderstood, and when it's brought to the noose of the soul, it is evaluated by a person who is out of fellowship and is no different from the unbeliever trying to learn the Word of God, and he will interpret the Word of God that comes to his attention under academic circumstances, academic understanding with regard to how he now views the world, his frame of reference, his norms and standards, his values, his belief system. And then that is something that he will put over here in long-term memory. and he will think that he's doing God's will. Robespierre, or any other tyrant, or anyone else who imposes their self-righteousness upon others through force if necessary. It happens in homes. Wives get brutalized by arrogant husbands. Children brutalized by arrogant parents. It moves out into the society in various ways. And it ultimately comes to where someone ruling a national entity can impose rules draconian-like on the people. And I am not a prophet, but I see the infusion into our society of draconian ideas because of fear. We are afraid of Islam. And because of our fear, we are adjusting our modus operandi, our daily run-of-the-mill things, and we are ignoring our Constitution, and it will be our undoing. We are being invaded. Invaded by thought. And we are in the process of going through delusion. And ultimately, someone, in order to restore order, is going to gain power over this country. A person with great oratorical skills, a person who is considered to be incorruptible, a person who is considered to be righteous before God and man, and he will begin to correct the problem. And you say, did you bring this right out of thin air? And I say, well, no, there's been a historical example of this beyond the Reign of Terror in France, and that is when the Chinese communists took over China back in the 40s. First thing they did was come in and shut down the whorehouses, the opium dens. They got rid of all of the gambling casinos, and all of the Christian missionaries that were over there stood and applauded and said, this is marvelous. We've been trying to talk these people out of going to those casinos. We're trying to talk them out of going to see those whores. We've been trying to talk them out of doing this, that, and the other thing, smoking dope and what have you. And lo and behold, this very righteous government's come in and they shut it down. Praise Jesus. And as soon as everybody got used to the government coming in and shutting down things, they began to shut down more things, and now they're shut down with except to the fact they're willing to take our money. What you wear today, have someone behind you. We could be like a Baptist church. Stand up and let the person behind you look at the tag behind your ear. I'll bet you it says Made in China. So we've got self-deception here. And the self-deception is what ultimately is the undoing of not only the individual, but that individual who gains power, there will be the undoing of those who are under his thumb. Now we've got to stop here. I've gone a little long, but we will take this up again for those of you who stay at about 10 till the hour.